from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome once again to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Thursday edition, as members are back home in their districts for Resurrection Week, voters are speaking out about their disappointment with the mammoth $1.3 trillion omnibus spending bill that was passed last week. Now, as we've talked about, that includes government funding for Planned Parenthood. House Freedom Caucus member Congressman Paul Gosar from Arizona joins us with more on this story, as well as a major court victory for religious freedom, a federal judge ruling the Obama-era contraceptive mandate violated the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We'll talk about that. Also, what does China, Iran, Iraq, Sudan, and Burma have in common? The answer, a striking lack of religious liberty. But what else do these countries have in common as it pertains to the United States? Well, stay tuned. Classes in session with Professor William Inboden later here on Washington Watch. And the liberal media has been trying to put evangelicals on a milk carton for years, constantly claiming that they're disappearing. But the government's own survey data says, well, I won't tell you what it says. I'll let Pastor Trevin Wax tell you. So you won't want to miss that interview a little bit later here on Washington Watch. All right, the website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T. Perkins. All right. Before leaving town last week, Congress passed a $1.3 trillion spending bill. Now, President Trump signed the bill, but grudgingly, he tweeted, "As a matter of national security, I've signed the omnibus spending bill. I say to Congress, I will never sign another bill like this again." Here to discuss the omnibus and more is House Freedom Caucus member, Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar. He represents the 4th Congressional District of Arizona. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, thanks for having me on.
All right, I know you voted against the omnibus bill, along with many other conservative members of Congress. What are you hearing from your constituents as you're back home?
People are upset. They're very upset that this passed and not doing due process. When you think about this bill was actually constructed by 4 people, 2 Democrats, 2 Republicans, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer, and Nancy Pelosi. And you see the complete giveaways that were given to the Democrats on this aspect. And then it came on the backs of conservative principles like Planned Parenthood about funding sanctuary cities. All this becomes problematic. And when people... The more they find out, Tony, and to be honest with you, the more we find out, because we weren't given the proper time to digest what was in that bill. I mean, we complained to Nancy Pelosi about having to pass a bill to find out what's in the bill. That's exactly what transpired here. So we're finding out that we took $1 billion in taking a property away from a mining company in California. This just becomes more and more absurd that we defunded a corruption case through the Inspector General's office. This is totally, totally wrong, and it shows that we have bad process. If we can have good process, we can have good policy, which can have good outcomes politically.
Well, you mentioned, Paul, the process, and as we were, in fact, every day last week, we had members on discussing it, and they said, well, the bill's coming. It's supposed to be posted. We're hearing it's going to be posted. And it wasn't. And you really, when you've got a 2,000-plus page bill, 2,200 pages, you get jammed in you know, just having a few hours to read it. It's impossible to connect all the dots. People don't really understand how legislation is crafted where it refers to another section of law, and so you got to kind of go over and look at that to see how this impacts it. So it's not just straight reading of 2,000 pages.
It's searching. Definitely right.
So is that process going to change? Are we going to go to where members have the ability to fully read these bills and also fully debate them?
Well, here's what's going to have to come out, and that is regardless of what people may say, is that the House did do its job for the first time in my 8 years. We actually passed a budget, and we did all 12 appropriation bills where you're assigning monies, eliminating monies line by line.
Right. And by the way, let me stop you right there so people understand. In that process, in our current setup where you have the you only have 51 votes in the Senate. That is also how a lot of policy issues are dealt with in these appropriation bills. So that this is not just about spending money, but it's how the money is going to be spent, what priorities will be established, and what guidelines will direct it. So it's more than just writing checks out or saying, all right, you can spend this money. It's how it's going to be spent. So it's very important these appropriation bills are done.
Yeah, so we could actually defund for a year that no money could be spent for abortions for anything anywhere in government-run health care. We could actually do that. Called a limitation amendment, and we do those all the time. So the House actually did that. The problem exists that the Senate did zero of those 12 appropriation bills, zero. And so when you don't do that, what ends up happening, you go back to these CRs, and the military was complaining about those CRs. Well, in the budget bill that was passed about a month ago, what it did is they agreed to do this on a two-year window, which means that we're now going to be complicit by allowing the Senate not to do their job again for another year. So therefore, my question is going to be to the president is, Mr. President, I know you're frustrated. They can only mire what my frustration and the Freedom Caucus's frustration is. Are you prepared to challenge the Senate that they need to either get to work where Mitch McConnell, through the confirmation process, starts keeping senators there 24/7 with the beds, the IVs, and the medics, and break them of this spirit and get back to doing the people's work. And that means passing the appropriation bills, start taking votes, and start going to conferences committee, because that's how our Constitution made it work. The House could have one opinion. The Senate could have another opinion. And then you join what they call as their different a conference committee where members from both sides hash it out. Not right. Staff members, members.
Right. Right. But, Paul, in essence or in reality, has it not come down to where, as you pointed out, and I do want to commend the House, they did go through the process, and this was a lengthy process, so I can understand the frustration on behalf of the House members and the leadership that go through this process of having hearings on their various appropriations bills, putting all of this together, only to see it die in the Senate. And it comes down to really Chuck Schumer being the one who is dictating how money is being spent.
Tony, you're exactly right. But you don't enforce a strategy at the last minute. You start it at the very beginning. And that's why I bring up the confirmation process. If Chuck Schumer came to the majority leader and said, listen, I'm going to require 30 hours for every conferee. We're going to slow this down to a crawl. If I were the majority leader, I'd have gone, you know what, Chuck? That's a great idea. I'm glad that you're going to be telling the rest of the members of the Senate that you're the one that caused them to stay here for 24/7, not going home. And by the way, there's 24 of you running for re-election. There's only 10 of us. So good luck explaining that. And I'm going to do this till I break you. That's how you do strategy. That's how you teach children that there are consequences for actions. Yeah. If you don't want to have the outcome come out, then get on board and start changing that. Have a conversation about the filibuster instead of what the current aspect is. Bring it to the floor and demand that maybe you have to go back the old way where you actually have to have a quorum on the floor and that you have to actually have to speak, not from your office, but on the floor until you drop and the gurney takes you out, then you vote. There's a lot of opportunities, Tony, that leadership should be doing. It's earned. It's not just given. It's earned.
Yeah. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. Congressman Paul Gosar, my guest, represents the 4th Congressional District of Arizona. Paul, let me ask you this. The president, when he signed it, first he said he was considering vetoing it. And I know the Freedom Caucus was weighing in with him to do that. Then he decided, well, I will sign it, but here's some stipulations. He said, we're not doing this again. Is that laying out the process that you talked about, that he's saying that, look, I'm not going to do this again. When you come back to me, we're going to have to do this the appropriate way?
Well, we can talk. We can talk. I respect the president. But what ends up happening to happen here is that let's look at realistic aspect. So the next budget, this current budget ends on September 30th.
Right.
Okay. So, and if we don't pass the next one, Now what happens? You're going to shut down the government during an election cycle? Then no one thinks like the Freedom Caucus. There's only 40 people of like minds that actually think that you can actually win on that issue. Most Republicans and most Democrats are scared to death of something like that. So if that's the reality that we want to have an outcome, we need to start peppering the Senate because they're the problem. We need to pepper Mitch McConnell. We need to pepper every single senator in our district to say, listen, why aren't you doing your job? I guarantee you, Tony, my two senators hate my guts because I'm out. I had two town meetings today, one with the Colorado Indian tribe, and then the other one with the city of Parker. And my comment is, our two senators need to speak out, because if they're not speaking out for change and reform, getting back to constitutional premises, then they're part of the problem. We have
And a lot of this we wouldn't even have to discuss if one of your senators would have voted the right way on the reconciliation bill, and we would have defunded Planned Parenthood and eliminated. We would have eliminated Obamacare.
And you know, once again, he also and his family doesn't like the fact that that's reiterated when the president said this is thumbs up, thumbs down. You are responsible for your actions. I'm sorry that he's not feeling well, but you also have to be accountable for your actions. And letting you side that is no excuse, absolutely no excuse, because when we come back to accountability, that's when America will function again, but it has to do with accountability, and it starts with the Senate. So we need to get on this, and we need to get on it now. Yeah, you know, people that are running for election signing an oath that basically says that they'll revert back to the old filibuster rules, and to have those conversations and discussions, to take up a budget and do the 12 appropriation bills, even if it means only having a 51-vote threshold for it. That's the principle.
And an important one at that. Hey, Paul, before we run out of time, we're just a couple minutes left. I want to get you to weigh in on a major court case decision from a district court level as it pertains to the Obamacare HHS mandate, the contraceptive abortifacient sterilization and related counseling mandate against the Catholic Benefits Association. They've been in court now for about 8 years going back to 2014. And yesterday handed a major victory. They won in their particular case. The court declaring that this was a violation of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and eliminating $6.9 billion in fines that had been accumulated against this Catholic organization. This shows, in my view, how punitive and what was really the design behind these penalties was really to drive these religious organizations out of business.
You're exactly right, Tony. This is a great victory for us. And that means that we have to relish that, but we have to not go further, because once you lose it, it's hard to restore it. But it also shows you that the administration was totally off their rocker. What they wanted was to encapsulate and demand that religious freedom be subjected to the federal government.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, thanks so much for joining us today. Good to
talk
with you.
Tony, thank you. Keep up the good fight.
You too. Paul Gosar, Congressman from Arizona. Coming up next, can America's promotion of international religious freedom strengthen America's national security? That's the question on the blackboard when we return. Class is in session. Don't go away. Hello, this is Tony Perkins from Washington Watch. You know, in all my years here at the Family Research Council, one of the things that encourages me the most about you, our listeners, is your willingness to help advance the things that matter most: faith, family, and freedom. Your support is enabling FRC to play a major role in the current administration's actions to protect religious freedom, as well as rolling back threats to pastors' free speech rights, just to name a few. But your help is needed for the work ahead as we seek to protect religious freedom in the military and finally defund Planned Parenthood. Please stand with FRC right at this moment. You can make your gift by going to TonyPerkins.com or make a gift by calling 1-800-225-4008. Again, our number, 800-225-4008, or go to TonyPerkins.com. God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
Hi there. Let's play a word association game. Are you ready? When I say Washington, D.C., what's the first thing you think of? If you're like many Americans, a word like corruption might top the list, but Christian might be the last thing you'd associate with Washington, D.C. Well, the truth is that Christians have voice in our nation's capital. For over 35 years, Family Research Council has been working daily to advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview. When the Christian worldview is being pushed out of the public, FRC is there to stand firm on a biblical vision for America. Will you stand with us? To learn more about Family Research Council and to find out how you can stand with us in defense of faith, family, and freedom, please visit FRC.org and follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest news and ways you can take action. Again, that's FRC.org. Most people remember Frederick Douglass as a fiery speaker who denounced slavery and advocated for the civil rights of African Americans and women. What is less known is Douglass's commitment to faith and family. In an exclusive FRC Speaker Series event, Reverend Dean Nelson and Colin Hanna explore the life of Douglass as a Christian minister, husband, and father, and examine how his legacy can be an example for Christian citizenship today. To view this important event, go to frc.org/Douglass.
Where is our country headed? Are we moving in the right direction? Mark your calendar for the Values Voter Summit on September 21st to 23rd in Washington, D.C. and join hundreds of Americans that want a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers include President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, House Speaker Paul Ryan, Kirk Cameron, Kellyanne Conway, Secretary Ben Carson, and Sean Hannity. Don't miss the early bird price of $99 at valuesvotersummit.org.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, class is in session. All right, two things that are not frequently spoken about in the same sentence, especially in Washington, D.C., national security and religious freedom. But a growing body of evidence suggests the two are connected. Joining me now to discuss this connection is Professor William Inboden. He is Executive Director of Clements Center for National Security and Associate Professor of Public Affairs at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas in Austin. He has served as a Senior Director for Strategic Planning on the National Security Council and has worked on the State Department's policy planning staff. Professor, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Tony.
Now, you say, and I read your piece, which is very enlightening, you lay out the history for this, that there is a correlation between religious persecution and national security threats, and that this is not something we've just discovered in the last couple of years.
That's right. I mean, this has been it's been a fact that's been around for a number of decades, but some of our policy leaders are slow to wake up to it. And I can put in a sentence for our listeners. There's not a single country in the world that respects religious freedom and poses a security threat to the United States. And on the other side, if you look at the countries that pose the biggest security threats to us, North Korea, Iran, China, Russia, militant Islam, they all are some of the worst persecutors of religious minorities, especially Christians, and violators of religious freedom. So there's a strong correlation there.
So, all right, is the religious persecution, is that the canary in the coal mine to say, hey, you've got problems? Or is it, if they ignore religious freedom, and that is a precursor to worse events that they will engage in?
Yeah, I think the canary in a coal mine is a great example, is that when we see oftentimes when a country or society is moving in a hostile and authoritarian direction, some of the first victims are going to be the religious minorities. Again, often
the weakest, the softest target, is it?
Yeah, that's it. And also the ones who are most threatening oftentimes to the regime, because they don't worship the state. They worship the God of the Bible. And we know he's our supreme authority. And so if you're a mullah in Iran, you're threatened by that. If you're a Xi Jinping in China or Kim Jong-un in North Korea, you're threatened by that. And so you're going to target
or a Caesar in Rome.
Exactly. Yeah. Or Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler. Think of any of the worst despots in human history. And that's one thing they had in common, is wanted to target religious freedom.
So your point is, and you go back to the beginning of the Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom, and in your piece you make reference to his first testimony, looking for Mr. Siepel, his testimony before Congress, that we should be looking for these things, because if we can point them out to say, hey, this is happening, it's a warning sign that bigger problems could be on the horizon.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of my policy suggestions, is that the intelligence community needs to pay more careful attention to religious persecution, again, as an early warning indicator of a looming security threat. You know, we just had Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats with us here in Austin speaking on campus today. You know, as you know, he's a strong Christian, a wonderful man. And this is something I know that he wants to see the intelligence community pay more attention to as well.
So if we as a nation, and of course Congress back in the late 90s when they established the Ambassador at Large for Religious Freedom, the whole purpose was to make this a foreign policy priority so that maybe we can nip this in the bud. If we see these problems, we can begin to address them, apply pressure, economic pressure, so that we might be able to head off a major military confrontation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I'm hoping now that, you know, Sam Brownback has been confirmed as President Trump's ambassador for international religious freedom. I've certainly, you know, spoken with him and his staff about this. And this is one of the things that they're going to be paying careful attention to, is saying this is not just a humanitarian issue. This is not just, you know, we don't advocate for religious freedom and religious minorities just to make ourselves feel good. But we do it because it's in our country's security interest, and it could help forestall a much bigger security threat down the line.
So, Professor Inbowden, that means that then kind of libertarians, others who really don't care that much about this issue, it's not their issue, although it's first freedom, I think it's a big issue, but for those that say not so much so, we can keep America from being entangled in costly wars in terms of treasure and people and everything else if we just kind of pay attention to this issue in the midst of other issues. Not saying solely focused on this, but it needs to be in the mix.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the reasons I was part of the congressional staff that had first passed that bill 20 years ago. And one of the reasons why we did that is we wanted, you know, it was the kind of hope is that an ounce of diplomatic prevention can be worth a, you know, a pound of military cure, if you will.
Right.
And so, yeah, this doesn't mean we're trying to remake the rest of the world in our image. It doesn't mean that we're doing this at gunpoint. It doesn't mean that we're not respecting other cultures and other religious traditions. But, you know, religious freedom should be a universal value. There's no one in the world who would say they want to be tormented or tortured for their religious beliefs. It's, you know, certainly something recognized in international law. And, you know, with just a little bit more diplomatic effort and, you know, perhaps some more development assistance going along with it, we can do some great good for citizens of other countries who want our help, who see the United States as their great advocate, as the only country that cares about their religious freedom, even if their own government doesn't.
So, Professor, I mean, many of these countries have signed on to the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which says that religious freedom is a human right, and that is the ability not just to have a religion, it's to not have one, it's to choose or to change. Many of these countries have signed on to that, but they don't live up to that standard. How can America coax them along to do that?
Yeah, there's no perfect recipe there. I mean, you're pointing out a lot of the hypocrisy of these countries who may pay lip service to this, but then honor it in the breach. But sometimes it's quiet diplomacy, just, you know, the president, the secretary of state, our ambassadors telling them, hey, this matters to us. This matters to the United States.
Right.
If you want to have better relations with us, then, you know, quit throwing your Christians in jail, or quit tormenting your Jews or whoever the religious minorities are. Other times it's doing direct outreach to those religious minorities, having our president, our Secretary of State meet with them. Sometimes it may be, you know, a few dollars spent in assistance, doing some rule of law training, you know, showing others that you can have a peaceful society with religious freedom.
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's making it a priority here so that people know we're serious about this. Professor Inbowden, thank you so much for joining us today. Great to talk with you.
Really enjoyed it, too. A pleasure to be with you.
All right. We'll be sure and have the professor back. All right, don't get up out of your chairs just yet. We've got more Washington Watch still to come. As we look at the media constantly wanting to put evangelicals on a milk carton as if they're disappearing. Not so. Don't go away. We're back after this. Hello, this is Tony Perkins with the Family Research Council here in Washington, and we're defending and advancing the things that matter most, faith, family, and freedom. Please stand with us right now. Our work depends on people like you who truly care about the future of our nation. You can make your gift by going to TonyPerkins.com or by calling toll-free 800-225-4008. Again, our number, 800-225-4008 or at TonyPerkins.com.
Most people remember Frederick Douglass as a fiery speaker who denounced slavery and advocated for the civil rights of African Americans and women. What is less known is Douglass's commitment to faith and family. In an exclusive FRC Speaker Series event, Reverend Dean Nelson and Colin Hanna explore the life of Douglass as a Christian minister, husband, and father, and examine how his legacy can be an example for Christian citizenship today. To view this important event, go to frc.org/Douglass. Who is speaking up for Christians in Washington, D.C.? For over 35 years, Family Research Council has been your voice for advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview in our nation's capital. Stand with us as we defend the truth and preserve the vision that our founding fathers had for this country. To learn more about FRC, go to frc.org and follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest news.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. This is because transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. Yet even the federal government has stated that there is no evidence that gender reassignment surgery has improved health outcomes. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right. You hear this quite frequently, where the media, they love to say that the influence of evangelicals is waning. It's dying. Especially you hear it before elections. We heard it before the last election. This could very well be the death knell of evangelicals. Of course, the results were much different than that, but even on the backside of that, said, well, yes, they voted in large numbers. They were a large portion of the voting population, but they're old and they're dying. And so they're not going to be that way for very long. Now, I've actually gone back, and in my first book, I actually did a chronology of this, going all the way back to Jerry Falwell. Almost every 4 years, you saw a recycling of the headlines. But And I argue contrary to that. People say, how can you be so confident? Well, by the very definition of evangelical is one who shares their faith. And if you're not sharing your faith and talking about a relationship with Jesus Christ, which has the ability to transform lives as hearts are changed, well, then you're not an evangelical. That's what evangelicals do. And so by nature, it's not going to die. It's going to continue to grow and even multiply. Well, the recent government data, the General Social Survey, which gathers all kinds of information, has been analyzed, it shows, as it turns out, evangelicals are not dying off. Joining me now to discuss this, Pastor Trevin Wax. He is a Bible and reference publisher at Lifeway Christian Resources, general editor of the Gospel Project, and a teaching pastor at Third Baptist Church in Tennessee. Pastor Wax, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Tony. Great to be with you.
Well, I saw your comments that were published in an article in relationship to this, and you say there's some motivation to these headlines. What motivates people to say that evangelicals are dying?
Well, I see motivations both from the people who write some of these headlines and then also even from some of the evangelical leaders that will share them. For a lot of people on the left, it's a sign of progress that evangelical churches are declining or that there are more people who are religiously unaffiliated in our day. For people who are in evangelical churches who share these headlines, I think there's a sense in which it plays into this sort of we need to, you know, we've got to be urgent about the need, and the church in America is dying, and so we've got to wake everyone up out of their apathetic slumber, you know, that kind of a mindset. But the reality
on one side they're celebrating, and the other side they're scaring. They're trying to scare people awake, and the other side they're calling for a celebration. But you say that the truth is, you know, somewhere in between there.
Yeah, you can read numbers and statistics in different ways, but a couple of things to keep in mind. As an actual number, there are more people who identify as evangelical in the United States today than at ever before in our nation's history. As a number.
Right.
As a percentage of the population, we're a little bit behind keeping up with population growth. So, you know, we're a little behind the curve there. I don't think that's a reason for celebration. That's obviously, I don't think that's a reason that we should be Chicken Little either. I think we've got challenges. There are more people in the United States that need to be evangelized, right? So we do have our challenges. But I think it's important for us to look at these statistics in light of a historical trajectory, to really take a look at where we are, so that we're not overly optimistic or overly pessimistic, but that we're balanced.
And let me give those numbers. I mean, since 1972, the evangelical church attenders have grown from 18% of the population after reaching in 1993 kind of a high watermark of 30%. The percentage has hovered around 25%, ranging from 27 to 23, and I think currently it's about 24%. So you're right; it is not on a trajectory of significant growth. It is hovering; it's holding its own as a percentage of the population. But I think it is two things for me. How I take this: number one is that evangelicals are not going to go away. Number two, we need to do a better job of sharing our faith to make sure that they grow. And it's not just passing it along to, you know, a couple of our kids, but we're starting in the home, teaching our kids, sharing the faith, living out the faith in such a way that it affects our coworkers, our neighbors, and everyone else we come in contact with.
Absolutely right. I would be the last person to say that evangelical churches, I'd be the last one to say we don't have problems. We do. We've got our challenges. You know, every generation has its challenges to face. If you want to look at churches that are actually, that you could say are dying, are in precipitous decline, you really have to look at the mainline denomination, the more liberal Protestant churches. They have been in steep decline since the 1970s, from about 30% of Americans identifying with those churches to about 10% now.
Pastor Wax, we're up against a break. Could you hold on through the break so we could wrap this up on the other side? Because I want to ask you another question, because you just touched on something that's extremely important. There is a decline, but I want to go a little further. Why the decline? Can you stick around?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Pastor Trevin Wax is going to stay around. I hope you will as well, because this is a very important question I'm going to ask him next about this decline in the mainline denominations, okay? All right, you're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Don't go away. We're right back with more Washington Watch and your phone calls straight ahead. Don't go away.
Somewhere out there right now, a teacher is using a new technique, not to teach some new math method, but to control the emotions of children in the classroom. Sounds like a conspiracy theory, doesn't it?
It's not. Social-emotional learning, known as SEL, is a new catchphrase that now dominates public education policy. However, hidden behind the SEL claim of building kids' self-confidence is a statist agenda of social engineering that insists on total conformity of thought. It disregards the genuine individuality of students and their family relationships and requires monitoring and tracking of their emotions. Don't miss FRC's new speaker series event featuring Stella Morabito, in which she discusses how SEL is programming our children by enforcing conformity, invading privacy, and undermining the influence of family and faith in a child's life.
Learn more at frc.org/SEL. Again, that's frc.org/SEL.
Most people remember Frederick Douglass as a fiery speaker who denounced slavery and advocated for the civil rights of African Americans and women. What is less known is Douglass's commitment to faith and family. The month of February marked the bicentennial of Frederick Douglass's birth, so it is a fitting time to reflect on the legacy of this great author, scholar, humanitarian, and entrepreneur who served 5 United States presidents. In an exclusive Family Research Council speaker series event, Reverend Dean Nelson, chairman of the board for the Frederick Douglass Foundation, and Colin Hanna, president of Let Freedom Ring, explore the life of Douglass as a Christian minister, a husband, and a father, and examine how his legacy can be an example for Christian citizenship today. To view this important event, go to frc.org/Douglass. Again, that is frc.org/Douglass.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins with the Family Research Council here in Washington, and we're defending and advancing the things that matter most: faith, family, and freedom. Please stand with us right now. Our work depends on people like you who truly care about the future of our nation. You can make your gift by going to TonyPerkins.com or by calling toll-free 800-225-4008. Again, our number, 800-225-4008, or at TonyPerkins.com.
Who is speaking up for Christians in Washington, D.C.? For over 35 years, Family Research Council has been your voice for advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and culture from a Christian worldview in our nation's capital. Stand with us as we defend the truth and preserve the vision that our founding fathers had for this country. To learn more about FRC, go to frc.org and follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest news.
All right, welcome back to Washington Watch. Okay, as we were discussing with Pastor Wax before we went to the break, we were talking about the decline in the mainline denomination. So let me before I bring you back in, let me just give you the numbers there. In the mid-1970s, close to 30% of the American population attended a mainline Protestant church. That has been declining since then to where in 2016 only 10%. So there is a decline taking place. It's not in the evangelical church. It is the mainline Protestant churches. Why is that? Joining me, Pastor Trevin Wax. He is Bible and Reference Publisher at Lifeway Christian Resources, General Editor of the Gospel Project, and as I mentioned, a teaching pastor at Third Baptist Church in Tennessee. All right, why is that, Pastor Wax? Why do we see this decline in the mainline churches?
Well, that's a good question. I think I would point to two major reasons. One of them seems simple, but on the face of it, it's just demographic. A lot of these mainline churches, people in these churches, the families are not big. They don't have as many kids. This is something that you see in more secularized societies across the world, a falling and declining birth rate. So first, we could just look demographically.
Let me stop you there. Let me stop right there. But that is connected to a bigger problem, in my view, and it is a declining view of children.
Yes.
And that ties back to a biblical understanding of not only the value of human life, but the fact that children are a blessing and not a consumer of resources.
That's absolutely right. So I would put that sort of trend in the mainline denominations that is mirroring secular society understanding of children within the framework of gifts from God. I would put that within that bigger theological framework. And that leads to a second reason why I think there'd be a decline, is that you have many mainline denominations that have very much liberalized their doctrine to the point where there's not as much distinctive there. You could say some of the power of Christianity as a counterculture is missing. And so, you know, G.K. Chesterton once said, we don't want a church that moves with the world. We want a church that moves the world. And I think that that is one of the challenges of mainline Protestantism, is that in many ways have become mirror images of the world. Evangelical churches, like we mentioned, are not keeping up with population decline as much, so that we don't have reasons to be proud or, you know, haughty to say, well, we're not dying as fast as they are. But I we're even seeing some demographic shift even in evangelicalism, which I think is challenging. We need to make sure that we are putting forth a Christian worldview with passion and fervor, even in our own churches. But
well, and
the
there are some
mainline.
There are some I'm hesitant to use the term evangelical, but some prominent Christian colleges and universities that teach it is irresponsible to have more than two or three children. And I think that we have taken this is in this thinking, this secular thinking has invaded institutions of learning that are identified as Christian. I think that's part of the problem. And I do think that even some of this cultural influence is having sway over evangelical churches. And that's why I think you see them following the same trend. And I think to the degree that we abandon the truth, I think future generations will abandon those churches because there is no distinction, as you said. And I mean, look, some of these mainline denominations have become nothing more than a glorified country club. And you can go to the country club and actually get lunch, so you might as well go there.
Yes, or as other people have said, it's basically, you know, the Peace Corps with a Christianized facade of some sort. You know, you can do community service and,
you feel good,
and some social work, but not necessarily is it connected to anything that is lasting. It is interesting when you look at demographics and birth rates and how they do play, they come from a wider understanding of the world and of children. It's interesting that in this regard, many evangelical Christians in Africa, for example, would have a very different approach than mainline Protestants here. Similarly, we'd have to say across the world, one of the major reasons that we are looking at trajectories of climbing numbers for Islam across the world is birth rate, is view
yes.
of children. And I think we have to look at that as and see these worldview ideas have consequences.
You are absolutely correct. When you look at the demographics and you look at what's happened in Europe, as the church there has been in decline, and part of that is you see the population decline actually slipping far beneath the replacement rate, and we're seeing that decline here in this country as well. There's two sub-demographics in this country that have kept up, in fact, have really kept the replacement rate as it is, I think at 1.9, is the Mormon church that does place a higher priority on children and homeschoolers in this country, which is a subset, generally speaking, of evangelicals. So, Pastor Wax, what are your recommendations to the church to ensure that the evangelical church does not only maintains its own, which it has for the last quarter of a century, but actually begins to grow and have a greater influence in the culture and in the country?
Well, I would these numbers are interesting because they give us a snapshot of how Americans see themselves, how they self-identify, where they would put themselves when it comes to the churches that they would say they belong to. But I don't want for a moment to think that 25% to 30% of Americans today that self-identify as evangelical are actually, when it comes down to it, convictionally evangelical in the traditional beliefs of Christianity that you would think that they
right.
would hold to.
Good.
We see some surveys, Lifeway Research has done surveys of people who say they're evangelical, and you find a lot of things that are troubling theologically there. So I think we have a lot of work to do in our churches. First with really putting forth with cheerful confidence and conviction the beauty of the Christian worldview, the beauty of the biblical way of life, putting that forth in our own congregations. And then I think we have to go out into the world with a greater confidence. A lot of Christians, I think, are afraid that because we have views that are outside the mainstream these days, that necessarily means we're going to be shouted down and pushed away, and that our message will fall on deaf ears. But what's interesting is that there are a lot of people who are suffering in the wake of some of the moral insanity that our country is experiencing right now, and there are aspects of the Christian view that are actually countercultural and appealing because they're countercultural. And we also believe in the Holy Spirit's power to move in people's hearts and to take this message of the gospel that is a global message, not just an American message, and is one that crosses centuries. It's not just in our own current moment. For thousands of years now, people have found their hearts changed by the message of Jesus' death and resurrection. That message is as powerful today as it always has been. So I think we need a good dose of confidence and courage to proclaim this message without compromise, with cheerfulness and love and winsomeness, to say Jesus is King and this is good news.
And Trevor, that was an excellent point that, you know, while we see an increasingly hostile culture, at least the vocal part of that culture to Christianity, there are those who have been left as casualties as a result of this cultural, everything goes, and they're looking for answers, and we have them, and so we should be bold and courageous in sharing them. Pastor Trevin Wax, thank you so much for joining us. Great conversation. Appreciate you.
Wonderful to be with you.
All right. Thanks so much. Pastor Trevin Wax, to find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. Follow the links over. All right. I went a little bit longer than I had expected there, but it was a good conversation because I do think, especially as we come into Resurrection Weekend, this is an opportunity for us. This is the weekend. This is the event of Christianity. I know the world celebrates Christmas, and that's great, the birth of Jesus. But it is his death, his burial, and his resurrection that gives us the hope. He didn't just come and try to model a good life like some of these other religious, quote-unquote religious leaders. He actually died on the cross for my sins and for your sins. He paid the penalty that you and I just, we couldn't do. I mean, there's no way we could pay what we owed. And so God sent his son. You know the verse, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. That's what we celebrate this weekend, that Jesus, tomorrow on Good Friday, he hung on the cross, he died, he was buried, but then on Sunday, on the first day, he was resurrected, overcoming the grave, and he is the first fruit of that, meaning that there is more to come, and that's where you and I come in. If by faith we accept God's grace, we will receive the forgiveness of our sins, and with that, new life. And not only new life, Jesus said, I come that you might have life and have it more abundantly. That's the ability to go through this life with confidence, this life with the freedom that comes from having your sins forgiven. I know this is a public policy program. We talk about policy. We talk about things in Washington, D.C., but we come at it from that worldview that God created it. God set the rules. We didn't measure up. But by his grace, evidenced through Jesus, a historical figure who walked on this earth, died, and again buried and resurrected, that gives us hope in the midst of anything. And he can walk with us. And that's what Trevin was talking about, us being bold and courageous to share, because there are some that have bought into the world's deception and lies And as a result, their lives are a wreck. Maybe you're there. I don't know. I know this past weekend when I was in California speaking, and I'm going to share that message tomorrow here on Washington Watch, but the reality is there are many lives that have just been devastated by the things of this world. And you and I should be as Peter wrote, that we should be ready to share the hope that's within us and why we can face the circumstances and the challenges of this life, and knowing that we can overcome them and knowing that this is not the end. And with that, we can help others along the way. And so I would encourage you to be bold in sharing your faith. And that's why we advocate so strenuously and with without reserve, and we will not give up on fighting for religious freedom. The ability that you have to live out your faith wherever you are. As a parent, being able to teach your children and not have that message contradicted by the government schools. As an employer, to be able to operate the principles of your business according to your Christian faith. Or as a nonprofit religious organization like the Catholic Employee Association that was on the hook for over $9 billion in fines because they would not buckle under to the government. Folks, as you and I live out our faith, it is a living testimony to the hope that is found in Jesus Christ. So we must never grow weary of doing that, even in the face of opposition. And as we face that opposition, again, to Trevin's point, there are those who are not going to oppose you. They're the ones who are going to hear you, and they're going to respond. But you've got to be willing to go against those who oppose that message, because they're the ones that are standing in the way of those who need to hear and want to hear. And you can be the difference. So please, I am not at all concerned that the evangelical church is going to go away. Now, I do believe it's going to go away at some point when the rapture comes, but I'm not going to be worried about it at that point. But until then, you and I need to be sharing our faith, living our faith, and moms and dads, it begins in the home. I cannot emphasize enough how important it is for you to be sharing your faith with your children. That's a great weekend to make that commitment to live out your faith in the home, the workplace, at school, or wherever you go. All right, folks, out of time. Thanks for joining us. Until next time, remember the words of the Apostle Paul. When you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.